And welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I'm Ann Nicholson-Weber, your host for this week's show, and I'm here today with three artists involved with the production of Elliot, A Soldier's Fugue, a play by Chiara Alegria Hudes, which is at the Steppenwolf Garage as part of their visiting company initiative. So we have Juan Vila and Megan Gerakis and Lisa Portes. Juan, can you just introduce yourself?
Sure. Like she said, my name is Juan, and I'm a Teatro Vista ensemble member. I've been here in Chicago for years. I'm from New York City, where I grew up, and I play Elliot in the show.
I'm Megan Gerakis, and I'm from Rivendell Theater Ensemble, and I play Ginny in this production.
Lisa.
I'm Lisa Portes. I'm a freelance director, and I've directed the production Elliot, A Soldier's Fugue, and I head the MFA directing program at the Theater School at DePaul University.
Great. Well, thank you all so much for being here. I thought we might start by talking a little bit about this piece, which is somewhat unusual in its form. Maybe, Lisa, you could first describe just kind of what it is about, and then we might talk of some of the artistic challenges it poses.
Sure. Elliot, A Soldier's Fugue is a story of a military family, and there's three generations of soldiers in the family. The grandfather, grandpops, served in the Korean War. Pops, the father, served in Vietnam, and their son, Elliot, is serving in the current Iraq War. And the mother, Ginny, was an army nurse in Vietnam. So it's a family. It's a, ultimately, the play is really the story of the ways in which war both bonds and separates, or bonds and fragments, a family.
Well, that's interesting you use that word, because what's striking to me about the show is how, I guess you could say, fragmented it is. I was talking before we turned on the mics about the form, which strikes me almost like four one-person shows interwoven. There are very few scenes where two actors are in a dialogue. So I would imagine that that poses very interesting challenges for the actors, and maybe Juan and Megan could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I would definitely say that is a challenge, because you are accustomed to having a scene with someone, looking directly at them and responding to what they're saying, observing them. But in general, for me, I either have someone who's imagining, just is there, but they're not physically on stage, or my lines come off of what other people are saying, but they're not necessarily talking directly to me. And it's a different, for me, it's a different form of your brain. I had done a show earlier this year, Still Life, and it was the same thing. It was three monologues, and it was three one-person shows that it overlaps. And I knew with that experience what part, how to approach this show. So it's very, very, very difficult, and you have to find a way to, I don't know, keep it organic in a way, as if they are there, as if you're there. So it doesn't seem, odd and out of place and disconnected from what's going on.
Were there things that you actually did differently in terms of preparing for the role?
It's a lot of detail work of who the other person is, if they're not there physically on stage. I have in the production, I have a soldier, his name is Waikiki, and I have he's my buddy in the show, and who we go through the war together, and I constantly am talking with him, and still I have to keep adding details and specifics of who he is, mm-hmm. So I can just sort of imagine the situation of how this dialogue would go.
Did you cast the role?
I do, and generally for any production I do, it's part of my homework of just like, who does this person look like? And let me recreate their history. Uh-huh. And for this one, yes, it is a friend from back home in New York City. So I definitely did. So it helps me a little bit just to laugh. But I got to still do the homework of how he is, how he speaks, his mannerisms, mm-hmm. things like that.
So that you have a picture of exactly what he's saying and doing when he's on stage invisibly to the audience.
Exactly. And that's, mm-hmm. it's still hard. It's still hard, because then I don't want to fall into sort of old habits of how I would be with him and forgetting that I'm on a battlefield, you know, in a place where people can hear you. But yet you have to have a stage whisper because you have an audience, and it's all those things, uh-huh. you have to kind of try to keep it in your head and in your body.
So technical challenges. And Megan, what about for you?
I think, as well as being simply a monologue, it's also direct address, my monologue. Mm-hmm. And in this piece, there's very little to support you, not just in terms of other characters, but in the scene, the scenography you see, it's very simple. So the real act of conjuring a lyrical, lush place is really very internal, and then yet you have to turn around and give it out. Mm-hmm. So it's a challenge. But the specificity, I think, as Juan said, is really
I mean, the key. I think actors talk a lot about one of the difficulties in scene work is to respond truly to what the other actor did, not to what you imagine they're going to do. Well, this is a case where, at least for Juan, who's got scenes with an actor that he's making up, you don't have that problem. But you also don't have the energy that you get from
exactly.
playing off somebody else.
Exactly.
Is there something that you do to substitute for that energy of another actor?
Mine is a different example because I do speak very specifically to the audience. So if
right.
people laugh, I mean, I'm right there with
you're
them.
You're in
so
relationship
that's,
with the audience.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I have a different impulse to share my story mm-hmm. in the piece. So I do get to use them, which is great.
You know. Talk a little bit about your character. I was interested to see that this play was co-produced by Rivendell, which has a mission of doing works relating to the feminine experience and women's voices. And this play is written by a woman. It has one woman out of the four cast members. And it's, I haven't counted lines, obviously, but it's not as big a part as Eliot's in terms of numbers of lines. But even more to me, it's not, there are things about it that are very feminine, but overall, I see it more as a play about the male. It's about the soldier and this three generations of soldiers. So your part is an interesting, very different from the other three. Just talk a little bit about Ginny as a person and as what you see her role in the play.
Well, I think ultimately it's about healing. And I think that the mother is, as well as the iconic, you know, yeah. mother, she's also been in the war. So it's not the little lady that waited at home with the pies or something. You know, she's very clearly mm-hmm. has shared their experience and just approaches it differently. Mm-hmm. So the idea that they can't connect, and I don't know that she really does either in a direct discussion with her son, but she can bring a just the feminine energy. And that's all it's a little simplistic, but I do think she's just simply a woman having shared their experience and just approaching it differently.
It's kind of an earth mother quality.
Well, I want to pop in on that. I mean, yeah. I think, first of all, I think if you were to count the lines in the show, actually everybody shares about equal stage time. I mean, Eliot's got the longest monologue, mm-hmm. But actually he doesn't speak a ton, you know? I mean, I guess you'd have more because you've got those TV interviews. But between the other three characters, I think they're about equal. And in fact, Ginny is much more. One of the things, when I read the first draft of this script, which was a year and a half ago, Ginny was a much more buried character. Mm-hmm. And in production, when Kiara did the production in New York at the Culture Project, the next draft I got, Ginny had been brought to the fore and, in fact, was included in the first scene. In a previous draft, she wasn't there until her monologue. Mm-hmm. In the next draft, she was there at the very top and the person actually bringing the soldier, introducing the soldiers and the situation. So she is not a buried character. She's a force in the play.
Yes.
And, in fact, a force that really both sends the men to war in the beginning, is at war with them, and heals, you know, at least her son is able to help him, not necessarily connect to his father, but help him through his experience. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, one of the reasons that, you know, I can't speak for Tara, but one of the reasons that Rivendell came aboard is because the Ginny, and also because as Megan said, this isn't the kind of mom waiting at home. This is a woman who went to war, and we forget yeah. in the world of soldiers, we forget about the women.
Yeah.
The women
yeah.
that are there, the women that are in the trenches, the women that are dealing with those bodies in their most kind of like vulnerable states
yeah.
and bringing them through. And so I think it's one of the aspects of the play that really attracted me to it in Kiara's writing.
It's a lovely scene where Ginny has been nursing the man who ultimately becomes her husband, and there's essentially a seduction in the hospital, which I was one of the most direct. I mean, that is a real scene, and it's I think maybe has particular power because there are so few scenes with two actors, and
Absolutely.
That's a very intimate. That's the one time where two characters really do relate very directly.
It's such a relief, I think, both for the actors and the audience
yeah.
when we get to that scene, because it's like, oh, thank God we're in scene. Because really, otherwise, people generally almost never look at one another.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few spots.
Mm. Well, as the director, what did you do about that? I mean, how did you approach rehearsal?
Afraid. No, I mean, I think, you know, we knew from the beginning that it was going to be a challenge on that front.
I don't think of it as four separate plays, interestingly. In the beginning, I did, and in fact was going to have four mics on stage, mm-hmm. you know, and have people at mic and their stories fuguing. But actually, like a fugue, it is four voices, but they operate they ultimately operate in unity. Mm-hmm. It is four experiences that live inside the molecule that is a family, even across seas from one another. One of the things that Kiara spoke about when she came was that when she first, this is based on her cousin who, you know, went to the Iraq War at 17, was wounded in the leg within 6 months, came back and was still the same kind of goofy guy, but had changed. And mm-hmm. she in a way that, you know, was, she could see immediately. And she was trying to explore what that change was, what war does. And he was the son of a Vietnam vet who never spoke about the war ever. And, you know, she was also trying to figure out why, when you know that it was traumatic for your father, would you sign up to go to a war? But she said when she first started to write it, she couldn't write it. It was too depressing. She couldn't mm-hmm. she couldn't spend a year working on it. And it was only when she began to think about this family, the love between them, the humor of the people, their fleshiness, their sexuality, their life, that she could really begin writing the play.
Well, it is a play very much about love and about family relationships. And actually, that's something I really admired about the piece, is that it comes at war through that door. But it is also very much a play about the experience of soldiers in wartime. And I wonder if you've talked to any vets, if you've had vets in the audience, or has that been an interesting angle for you as actors?
Luckily, yes, we have had who was Lieutenant Ruiz, is now Colonel Ruiz, Bob Ruiz, who's also a doctor. And he's been our sort of, what would you call him?
Mentor,
who's been consultant. Yes, angel, definitely really. Consultant and angel.
And his wife,
Phyllis, you know, who he served in the Vietnam War and also in the Iraq War. And he's had a couple of tours.
He did what? The Vietnam War, the Gulf War, and the current war.
The current Iraq War. Yeah. And then his wife, Phyllis, was in, she's
Vietnam, been, I think, primarily Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And she's
a nurse.
And they've been very, very helpful, especially him, because he came back to give us a talk.
How did you connect to these?
Tara Mallon and David New were at the Pritzker War Memorial Library Gala and seated at a table with him and just began to speak about the play. And it almost directly mirrored some of his experiences. And I think it's very common for young men and their fathers to not speak about war. And so it just opened up a whole vein. And he came to speak to us at one night at rehearsal. And that was just unbelievable.
I should just pop in. His father served in World War II, and then as we said, he was drafted to Vietnam and then stayed in the military. And actually, he was Lieutenant Colonel Robert Ruiz and just was promoted days ago, actually, to Colonel Robert Ruiz. Mm-hmm.
So he came and saw the show?
No.
He hasn't seen it yet.
Oh.
No, he's coming for either opening or the gala or both.
But he came and talked about
it. He and his wife both came and spoke about their experiences as a family, as individuals, as members of the military, as children of, they were both military brats. So it mirrored the whole idea of the legacy. I think a lot of people that serve in the military come from military families often, you know. And it was so present for them, these experiences that were 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 5 years ago, 2 days ago. He just returned. And I remember his wife, it's so present and they are so emotional about it so deeply without speaking about it a lot. They both thanked us for giving them the opportunity to speak about something that they don't really speak about. And that happened, I think, the other day. As to your question about vets in the audience, I think it's really important to tell this story because this is something so inexpressible, as Lisa said earlier, that this shared experience, this energetic, this reciprocity allows them a little bit of catharsis.
And it does, you know, when you read a script, you know, you're trying to create your own world, you're be as realistic with the characters, make it your own. And it's a little bit, it's confirming when you actually meet a person in when you meet them and then they tell you their experience and it ends up being this mirroring the same experience that you have on stage. And it's like, okay, this is really like, it's not just a story. Like this is actually, it's a true human story, you know, with him and his father, his son, who also wanted to enlist also. And it mirrors the journeys in the play and also what he went through in his life. And it's, you only hope to do it justice. That's really kind of a big, big, big thing that's constantly on my mind.
And speaking to, you know, we'd been talking earlier about the challenge of the play, and Juan was talking about making things specific. And when Colonel Ruiz and his wife came, a number of things that they said just helped us understand on a very human level and a very specific level very things in the play. For example, he was talking about how in Vietnam, you know, we didn't want to leave any soldier, any part of any soldier behind. And so we brought back every body part, any piece of a soldier. Yeah, we brought back so that they could be buried on American soil. And Eddie Torres, who plays Pops, has a line about he's been scouting for body parts. And previously we'd been playing with the idea that it was just a kind of gruesome activity. But once we understood that he was actually scouting for his brothers, for his fellow soldiers, it took on a whole new color and level and truth, really truth. Mm-hmm. And
when Kiara
God
was,
bless him.
Absolutely. Oh, God.
God bless Colonel Ruiz and
absolutely.
His wife.
When Kiara was here at the talk back, someone asked her about the genesis of the play, and she spoke about interviewing each member of the family, and her uncle was had never spoken about it. And she went into
not even to his wife.
Not even to his wife, right, who was also in the military, I believe. And when she went in to interview him, she was really nervous. She was like, she had a list of questions. How was it going to go? He was so reticent and so taciturn that it was not going to be good. She asked the first question, and he spoke for 4 hours without any more questions.
Wow.
And later said, like, the burden of 30 years had been lifted, that he'd carried that around.
Well, there's something very lovely and, I guess, ironic in a way. The play, in part, is about the inability of the different generations of soldiers to talk about their experiences, but the play does that for them.
I think that, you know, what's really honest about the play is that it is also, I think that's why it's written the way it's written. It could be very reductive. It could be grandpops suddenly talks to pops and says, hey, son, this is what happened. The play is very honest to the experience and does not connect them, remains actually, with the exception of one moment, two moments, is honest to the experience. But I think in its being truthful, I hope it provides a touchstone for the possibility of conversation. Or even the possibility of simply shared space.
Have you reached out to veterans for the show?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a performance tomorrow night with a veterans group, and the National Vietnam Veterans Art Museum has been kind enough to lend us some of their art, and they have an incredible exhibit right now, In Defiance of Tradition, where men created pieces in Vietnam, since Vietnam, but they would use their sea rations and coffee grinds to paint things because it's that inexpressible that they, you know, or that urgent for them. And it's an amazing exhibit, and everyone should get down there and see that. But they're also going to have some of their stuff here. So we've been able to partner with them. That's been great.
Great. I understand that the playwright did come to a preview performance. And what was her reaction? Did you?
Well, it was an unusual night because one of the actors is back. Actually, the person who plays Grandpa, Gustavo Mediado.
It was our first public performance.
Oh my God, it was a nightmare.
Yeah, it was our first public performance.
We had the playwright here. It was, you know, we were all ready to go. We'd rehearsed. It was 7:30, and suddenly I had the assistant director, Rachel Walsh, came and said, Lisa, can I speak to you? And I was out here talking to Kiara, and I went backstage, and she said, Gustavo's throwing his back out. He's on the floor.
Oh.
He can't go on. And yeah.
We were freaking out backstage, you know, of course, thinking of his health, and then just like, you know, what are we going to do with the show? Trying to figure out different options. So it was so for myself, it was a different performance just because I, you know, you prepare beforehand, at least, you know, you try your best. And then to have that, you know, it ended up happening. It did end up happening. The show, he just sat on the chair and he just sat on a chair on stage. And it was interesting just the effect that it had for Lisa.
And God bless Tara Mallon, because she actually, she's the Rivendell Artistic Director and was very calm in the face of a storm, because I didn't know what to do. We were thinking, should we cancel the show? What should we do? Kiara's here. And Tara was very kind of calm. She said, well, what if we just put Gustavo on stage in a chair? And luckily, a Rivendell company member, Keith, was there that day as well. So we knew that if Gustavo couldn't sit in the chair, Keith would sit on stage and read the lines.
Uh-huh.
But we knew we were going to go ahead and have that. And I learned a lot from it. I learned actually that, you know, we could very easily, we could afford to get out of our way, because Gustavo simply sitting there, knowing what he was saying and communicating clearly with the audience, very simply and very clearly, you know, it was actually kind of lovely.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually kind of lovely, and it was a good lesson for me.
Well, did you then talk to Kiara after? Did she have a reaction to your performance?
God bless her. She was so supportive. Mm-hmm. She was incredibly supportive of Gustavo and of the piece. She had a couple technical notes for me, and then she saw it again the next night, and Gustavo was in, so she was able to see, you know, the production
what
that we'd
meant.
Actually staged.
Right.
Yeah, and she was very supportive. She had like 3 technical notes, and other than that, she was, I think, very pleased, I hope. She seemed to be.
No, I think she was the one that brought the idea of, while it's a play about war, it's ultimately a play about love, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we were so busy sort of marching around trying to execute a lot of specific technical things that she just wanted to kind of give that boost. And I thought that was really important for me specifically. Mm-hmm.
You know? That's something that I, with the piece, I try to tell friends or anybody who I'm talking about the show. I'm like, I know it's a war piece, but it's funny. You kind of get that. The other side of, you know, the human experience of just how, what it was for them, what they were beforehand, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to how they are when they get back. So you get to see, you know, the life and the joy and the love and what was there and what you're trying to grasp onto and get back to, especially when you get, because with the way the show works, different time, because it's like present and then it's the past and then it's present and it's all overlapping.
Right.
And for such a polemic issue, it's very, non-specific. Mm-hmm.
That's what attracted me to the play, is that it is a play about the experience of soldiers, but it's a play about the human experience of a family and soldiers. It's not a polemical play. It's not a play that takes a position. Mm-hmm. It's a play that's really about, you know, the experience as she saw it. She saw her cousin and her uncle and my aunt, you know, go through. And it's human. It's human. It's fleshy. It's sexual. It's funny. And in moments, heartbreaking, and in moments, joyous.
Yeah.
And actually, that's she made an interesting comment, Kiara, of just when at the talkback of when she saw the production and doing the talkback afterwards, she was saying that when she wrote it, she would never have thought the war would still be going on right now. And so she.
When was it written?
I read it last year. I think it was written in 2003, I believe.
Yeah, it sounds like around there when she first started it, at least. So she didn't think it would be as significant.
Here in 2006, still be there. Yeah. Did you, Lisa, did you have any communication with her during the rehearsal period?
We were in communication via email. Interestingly, I didn't do a lot of emailing her. I think it's the first time in about 10 years, I think, that I've worked on a new play without the playwright in the room. Generally, I work with the playwright in the room, but because this was, I think, the third production of the piece, you know, we were lucky to get Kiara out to come for a preview.
Right.
But it was very strange, because you don't know, you know, when you're working without the writer, if you're on the right track. And especially with this play, when you're really guessing, you know, what's the vocabulary physically, what will work. I knew I wanted it to be simple. Mm-hmm. I knew I wanted there not to be a lot in the space, which was very challenging for the actors, because there's really nothing to hang your hat on. There's not the other actor. There's not a set piece. There's not a prop. There's just you and the language and the audience and, you know, the other characters that are near you but not mm-hmm. with you. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of casting about in the dark a bit. And
kind of the worst of both worlds, because when you do a dead playwright, it's hard to know what they want. But on the other hand, they're not going to come and tell you you got it wrong.
Right. So. And, you know, I mean, Peter Brook, and I'm not going to quote this directly, but Peter Brook has this quote in The Empty Space about, you know, the director, you know, kind of being the captain of a kind of boat that's going along a river, but the director is in the dark as well. Mm-hmm. You know, you're in charge of leading it, but you're in the dark, you know, you can't see either. And I felt that acutely on this process. Mm-hmm. And so when Kiara came, I was, you know, I was pretty, not worried, I would say I didn't know what would happen, because she could have come in and said, you got it all wrong. I don't know what you're doing.
Right.
La, 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 la. But she actually, you know, I thanked my heavens that, you know, we seemed to have found a vocabulary that worked and that she was supportive of and found beautiful. And
well, it obviously worked for the audience that I saw it with. So there's obviously more than one arbiter than the playwright.
Absolutely. But it's ultimately when there's a playwright. And because I'm a director of new plays, I have deep respect for writers and for their visions. And she really, really, for me, it's like at this point, I don't care really who likes it as long as you did. Right. No, I do care, because it's for the public beyond that. But
right. You know. But there is obviously a great responsibility to the
absolutely.
Living playwright.
Yeah. Absolutely.
My husband's a playwright.
Oh,
so I care
great.
About that
you know,
too.
Mine is too.
Yeah.
We can talk.
Yeah. Right. Well, let's talk a little bit. Another interesting aspect of this production is that it's a co-production of Rivendell and of Teatro Vista. And then it's beyond that, being produced at the Steppenwolf Garage. So there are 3 entities involved. And I imagine that creates a different kind of complications and challenges. Maybe Juan and Megan, you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's interesting, because I think the general opinion is, you know, co-production is, it's easier financially. And, you know, you have two companies working together. And it can actually be a little bit tougher only because you don't want one person to do more of the work than somebody else, or you end up maybe spending a little bit more because you have another company. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting, this is my first experience involved in a co-production and just seeing how it runs. And it's good because you have another company and another set of eyes, another perspective. But then you have to try to, you know, carry your own. And I think that's a challenge in itself. Just like when one person's used to being in charge, and then it's right. Like, well, we have the other person also from the other company, and trying to coordinate, be on top of things, and they have their way of running things, we have our way of running things, and then just trying to find happy medium without, mm-hmm. you know, stepping on toes or anything like that.
I like to say it's like a marriage between people who are like in their 30s, because you've been around long enough to run your own life the way you run it, and then right. Suddenly you're in a house with somebody else, and you got to deal with somebody else's rules.
Well, I think beyond logistics, it's also a chance to broaden the community. Rivendell's done a lot of co-productions, and that's been fantastic because they're a small company in Chicago. And they co-produced with Power Tap, Hamlet, and Cyrano. And I remember thinking that was a really good marriage because those two plays required not just beyond casting and financial support, the artistic component of the other company. So you learn a lot, and you can synthesize and
cross-fertilize in
absolutely
style.
And I think it is true that you, because it's such hard work running a company, you do sort of get single-minded, and then the opportunity to work with a company that operates differently broadens your artistic perspective as well as as well as learning just tricks, you know, great grant writing tricks or whatever, something more practical.
Well, maybe, Lisa, you can just tell the story of how, I mean, I understand that you brought the piece to both companies, and that was the genesis of the...
Wah-ha-ha-ha-ha. I was, I'd been interested in Kiara. I'd read a piece of hers called Barrio Girl, and in fact, I read it on an airplane when I was going out to the TCG conference in Seattle, and Eddie was on the same airplane, and Eddie Torres, the artistic director of Teatro Vista, and I remember reading Barrio Girl and running back to the other side of the plane and going, Eddie, you got to read this play, you got to know this writer. So I gave him the play. And then I read Elliot, and I thought, oh, we got to do this. And Tara and I had been talking about doing something, and conversely, Eddie and I had been talking about doing something.
Tara's at Rivendell.
Yes, Tara's the artistic director of Rivendell Theater. So I read Elliot, and I first brought it, because it was a woman writer, I brought it to Rivendell, and there was a question, I think, initially about, you know, whether there were the right company members in Rivendell for the piece. So then I brought it to Teatro Vista, and Eddie was very interested in the piece. And then at the same time I brought it to Teatro Vista, Rivendell became reinterested in the piece. So I said, hey, you guys, well, you know, you guys are about women art theater artists, and you guys are about Latino theater artists, and Kiara is a woman and a, you know, Latina, and so am I. So why don't you maybe talk about it? So Rivendell and Teatro Vista then began talking. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I think, you know, Tara had been pursuing the guest slot at Steppenwolf, and had the guest slot before with Self Defense, Carson Kreitzer's play, which was fantastic, directed by Ed Sobel. And so she then brought this marriage, Teatro Vista and Rivendell, and this play to Steppenwolf as part of, you know, they receive a number of applications for their visiting artist
right.
slot.
Right.
And luckily Steppenwolf came aboard, and that's how the three got married. and it has been challenging, and it's also been terrific. It's been terrific to have the mentorship of Steppenwolf Theater. Mm-hmm. It's been terrific to have two sets of eyes. You know, the Rivendell, you know, as a director, you get notes from various folks, you know, as they're watching the show. It's been terrific to have the Teatro Vista eyes. It's been terrific to have the Rivendell eyes. It's been terrific to have the mentorship of Steppenwolf in their eyes.
I was pretty sure at the show that there's a scene where a anchor woman or an interviewer, a television interviewer, is interviewing Elliot, and the voice you hear, I was pretty sure was Martha Levy, artistic director at Steppenwolf. So you had very direct, obviously, artistic
yes.
input.
And we should say David
well.
New, who was really with us, after the first read-through said, hey, I know three people who can do these voiceovers because I bet you don't want the cast to do them. And I was like, hallelujah, because mm-hmm. I really didn't want to hear the cast's voice
right.
in that. And I wasn't quite sure what we would do. And he brought us
Ben Calhoun
from WBEZ.
NPR. Yes, in the end, NPR.
Pretty much went down the list there. I'm sorry. He's the Chicago political correspondent, Ben Calhoun. Paul Conrad from WGN News, and Martha Levy, who's the artistic director of Steppenwolf. So we actually have a fantastic lineup in those interviews.
Well, there's one example right there where it was fun when we did the recording, because it was a couple of weeks into the rehearsal, of seeing the person in front of you and it kind of giving me okay, and they give you so much more than what you honestly I even envisioned. So going back to saying about just playing off, because I have to do those interviews off – tape. Off the voice, technically just off the speakers, but it's so colorful and it's so clear, and it just gives me something to play off. And just to see them also, their energies in person were very different. Mm-hmm. It was very clear, and I loved that, and it made it so much more come to life. And so it's fun each night. I know from the beginning, I was like, oh man, it's going to be the same voice. It's going to be the same way it's done every night, but it's so different. As long as I take care of what I need to do, how they say their next line, it's actually some of my favorite ones to do.
But wait, you're saying it hits you different. I mean, it is in fact pre-recorded. It is the same every night, but you're saying it hits you differently.
Yes, because also it's not sort of like, okay, here's a recording. It's going to last 1 minute, so you got to fill in the lines. Mm-hmm. It's not that. I have the freedom of,
because the stage manager cues it.
It's just clear. Sometimes people can just have a very simple voice that don't offer much, and then it's just like, okay, we're just gonna get through this. But that's actually some of the most fun, and to hear the audience respond to it also has been a blast.
And that's a testimony. It's a testimony to Juan, and then seeing the live bodies, seeing Paul Conrad, seeing Ben Calhoun, seeing Martha Levy, you're able to keep them fleshy and alive for yourself, so that even though it's the same, it's a recording, you've got a whole life to it, so it comes out differently every night. And actually, I have to say, this play is a bear of a play for actors, and I just have to take my hat off to the cast, because it requires the tremendous imaginative and sensory talents on their part to keep the piece burbling, and they do it beautifully. So,
well, in this case, it's a very happy collaboration among the three enterprises, and I want to thank you all for coming. Maybe Megan, you could just quickly give a plug for the show.
Absolutely, please come see us, Elliot, A Soldier's Fugue, at the Steppenwolf Garage Theater, 1624 North Halsted. We are running November 12th through December 10th, Thursday through Sunday. And you can buy tickets online at www.steppenwolf.org or call 312-335-1650. Thanks.
Well, Juan, Megan, and Lisa, again, thank you so much for your time and your thoughts.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.